This is The Takeaway. I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host and producer of NPR and WNYC's Consider This in for Tanzina Vega. In Texas, 2 weeks after a severe winter storm caused statewide power outages, more than 160,000 residents are still being advised to boil their water before consuming it. Thousands of other Texans have also lost running water completely because of burst pipes. And as people across the state continue recovering from the storm, some are also finding out they might not get paid for hours they missed during the extreme weather. Recent reporting from the Daily Beast revealed that dozens of Texas employers are giving their workers the option of either using vacation time for days they couldn't work because of the storm or not getting paid at all. In other parts of the country, workers have also had to contend with the troubling combination of climate change and labor. During recent California wildfires, many farm workers have remained on the job even amid dangerous air quality conditions. Otherwise, they'd risk losing their pay entirely. With me now is Nadia Marin Molina, co-executive director of the National Laborer Organizing Network, and Stephen Monticelli, publisher of Protean magazine and an independent journalist based in Dallas. He also broke the story on Texas employers for the Daily Beast. Nadia, Stephen, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
Stephen, you heard from employees at dozens of different companies in Texas who were given the option to either take vacation time or not get paid for hours they didn't work during the storm. What types of companies are we talking about here?
Well, I heard from quite a few folks across Texas. The trend that I saw in the messages that I received, which included lots of emails and text threads from their employers, primarily seem to come from fairly large multinational employers, as well as some mid-sized businesses. And this included everybody from, you know, like a large weapons manufacturer like BAE Systems to a Toyota to, you know, a local hospital here in the Dallas area, as well as even the city of Dallas itself. So it was quite a range, as well as some colleges that I had seen as well. But primarily what I had heard was, you know, mid to large size employers that tend to have thousands of employees.
And how similar were the different messages you reviewed from employers regarding pay policies?
It's a great question. Broadly speaking, they had a lot of similarities, and the tone was generally just very declarative. This is what the policy is. Some went so far as to suggest that it's employees' responsibilities to set aside their paid time off for events specifically like this, which you know, is something that folks perhaps predicted the extent of the storm, but I don't know if anyone exactly predicted the extent of the catastrophe that unfolded afterwards. So it was a lot of that. There were some that would suggest that the sender of the message was not pleased with the policy and that they were pushing back. But broadly speaking, you know, very similar policies and very sort of tone, which is this is the way that it is.
Nadia, have employers taken similar approaches to worker pay during other natural disasters like Hurricane Harvey or Hurricane Katrina?
Unfortunately, yes. From Endelon, we have member organizations, worker centers across the country who work with day laborers and low-wage immigrant workers, and often they're second responders who come in after an emergency to do cleanup, right? After floods, wildfires, and other disasters, but they're also directly affected by the disaster at home, and they face loss of income and the general lack of worker protections, even when they do work, right? So that can relate to both their income, their health and safety on the job, and other worker protections.
Yeah, and do most lower wage workers even have paid time off as an option? Like, what happens in these types of weather events to hourly workers like grocery store clerks or those who work at, you know, fast food restaurants?
Well, there is no real safety net that's required by law in most states. And so most of the time, workers who don't have a specific policy around that have no safety net at all. And in the case of disaster, that problem comes up and is exposed.
Stephen, were the workers you spoke with in Texas at similar job levels and making similar wages, or did their positions vary?
I would say their positions varied. I heard from folks, everyone including hourly wage workers to salaried employees and even some managers who had direct reports. What I did not generally hear from were director level and above sort of folks that would have perhaps the ability to make these sorts of decisions or would have the responsibility for communicating them to large amounts of people. The folks that I heard from, even that had salaries, were concerned that if they, you know, were not able to be paid, that they would even have issues with paying rent and other things like that. Because I think just because someone is a salaried worker, it doesn't necessarily imply that they aren't also, you know, living paycheck to paycheck.
Mm. How did the workers you spoke to feel about the way their employers have handled these pay policies following the storm?
It varies. Generally, folks, I think, were quite upset. The sort of phrase that I would use to describe how most folks seem to feel about this was, you know, they thought it was adding insult to injury, and they felt sort of betrayed by their employers. Others were pleased. You know, there were examples of employers that chose to go above and beyond and pay their workers and offer mental health support and open their offices as even shelters if they had power during the storm. So, you know, there were some folks that were pleased. And then there were some folks that even saw their employers walk their decisions back after receiving pushback. And then allow their employers to then actually receive pay for the emergency. So it just, I think, has varied depending on the situation that workers have found themselves in, which is the unfortunate result of having no regulations. It's been entirely up to the decisions of management, you know, to decide whether folks would be able to be paid or take vacation.
Employee protections vary from state to state. So, Nadia, which state or states offer the most comprehensive worker protections?
I mean, there are states, for example, like California and New York, which have greater protections in certain areas. So higher minimum wages, or even in some cases, paid sick leave policies or paid family leave policies. But these are actually fairly rare. And they're because organizations have and workers in each of those states have really pushed for them. And in most states, there aren't policies for paid time off. And in states like Texas or Mississippi, where there are the least protections, then workers really are left to fend for themselves.
And is FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, able to provide assistance for individuals who couldn't get to work during a natural disaster?
There are programs that are created in order to provide disaster assistance or disaster supports. Many times workers don't know whether the programs exist. They don't know whether they qualify for them. And in some cases, are unwilling or may not be able to apply if they're excluded from federal assistance. And so it really depends. And those programs also may come late, right? In terms of the response to disasters, workers need immediate protection, immediate income. And sometimes those programs come much later than they need to for workers.
Stephen, The Takeaway reached out to a number of the companies you reported on. And so far, we've heard back from BAE Systems, a multinational security company. And they sent us a statement that reads in part, quote, "In Texas, our businesses are applying various mechanisms to ensure that every employee will have a way to receive full pay, including in some cases by taking personal holidays or paid time off." They also said they've issued around 240 grants to employees affected by the storm. So how does their response compare to some of the other companies you heard back from?
Well, I think that's a step. You know, I don't know if that necessarily meets the desires of most employees that I've heard from, which, you know, they're really what they're asking for is support during a very, very tumultuous time. And if that support does not reach the entirety of workers at a company, I'm not sure if that meets the desires or the needs of the folks that I've heard from. I can tell you, you know, firsthand that across Dallas, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that are still displaced from their homes and still without food and water, access to that, you know, regularly. And many of these folks are either unemployed or are working a job that they cannot afford to miss. And so a lot of, you know, mutual aid groups, which there's been a lot of coverage about them recently across Texas, have been stepping in to fill this void that Nadia pointed to with regard to the delay that often occurs with this sort of assistance that comes from the federal and the state government. You know, folks need a roof over their heads and they need food and water now. And I don't know if a lot of them can afford to wait several weeks for that to arrive.
And lastly, Stephen, Texas Governor Greg Abbott recently announced that next week he'll be ending a statewide mask mandate and allowing all businesses to open at full capacity. What have you heard from workers about those changes?
I've written a little bit about this for the Daily Beast, and I'll be publishing another piece with a separate publication soon, specifically about service industry workers. And folks do not seem very pleased, at least the ones that have spoken with me. You know, they are still reeling from what has happened in the past few weeks. Just because the storm is over does not mean that the aftermath is over. And now they feel like many of them feel like they're being pushed into dangerous situations where they will be increasingly held responsible for, you know, their own safety and will not be able to cite a state law. We've already had a lot of problems, and I've heard horror stories from service industry workers about folks who refused to comply with the law around masks when it was a mandate. And so now that it will no longer be in place, many are concerned that it will embolden the folks that choose to use the masks as a political statement as opposed to an issue of public health.
Stephen Monticelli is the publisher of Protein Magazine and an independent journalist based in Dallas. And Nadia Marin Molina is the co-executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you.
And we also reached out to Beltextrin and United Ag and Turf. We'll add their responses if they get back to us. The city of Dallas did respond, and we have that statement up on thetakeaway.org. The drive to unionize Amazon workers in Bessemer, Alabama, continues to intensify, with some celebrities and elected officials announcing their support. And last weekend, although he didn't endorse the formation of the union, President Biden chimed in.
Today and over the next few days and weeks, workers in Alabama and all across America are voting on whether to organize a union in their workplace. This is a vitally important choice as America grapples with the deadly pandemic, the economic crisis, and the reckoning on race. What it reveals, the deep disparities that still exist in our country.
For the past few months, the Amazon workers in Alabama have been organizing against a company that has vehemently fought unionization efforts in the past. And in early February, workers began casting their votes on whether to form a union or not. Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, Amazon workers began denouncing difficult working conditions, saying the company was exploiting them, making them work long hours for little pay and under precarious conditions. If the majority of workers in the Alabama warehouse vote yes, this will be the first Amazon workplace to be unionized. Here to help us understand the unionizing efforts in Alabama is Lauren Kaori Gurley, staff writer at Motherboard, Vice's tech site. Lauren, great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me, Rebecca.
Can you tell us what workers have been telling you regarding the unionization efforts? How are they feeling?
Yeah, I was actually down in Bessemer, Alabama last week interviewing workers. I think, you know, there are very strong yes and no camps and still a lot of undecided or uninterested voters. I think people, the job is extremely draining and difficult. And, you know, you have a lot of people who are really focused on that. That said, I think there's, like I said, there is a very strong, like, contingent of workers who feel that, you know, this warehouse only opened in March of 2020, so it's brand new. They feel like Amazon has let them down, like they did not realize how stressful and straining on their bodies and mental health this job is. They didn't recognize that before, and they began organizing very early on and received, like, the union drive gained momentum, you know, quicker and more forcefully than any other Amazon union drive that has, you know, taken place so far in the company's history.
You've reported on the many ways Amazon has challenged unionization efforts. So let's break down some of these examples in Alabama. What kind of outreach has Amazon been engaging in with workers?
Oh my God, so much outreach. It's in some ways, it's a classic union busting campaign. They are, you know, posting signs in their warehouse telling workers, you know, why, you know, joining a union would potentially take away some of their benefits, could lower their wages. There are signs in the bathroom stalls. They are receiving almost daily text messages from Amazon using this same rhetoric. There have been captive audience meetings. Some workers have been, you know, captive audience meetings are when the employer forces workers on work on the clock to sit through an anti-union presentation. They are paying the top union busting law firm and consulting firms in the U.S. to fight this union drive. Some of the more unconventional things they're doing, a lot of this organizing for this union drive has actually incredibly taken place on a small strip of sidewalk outside of the warehouse in Bessemer, where organizers have access. It's a brief moment before the street light changes where workers and organizers can talk. Amazon had the traffic light where this was all taking place changed and made it shorter. They requested from the county, Jefferson County, where Bessemer is, to change that stoplight, which was sort of what their whole strategy was predicated around that. They've also installed a USPS mailbox on site. They're not allowed to do on-site voting. The NLRB said no on-site voting because of COVID, only mail-in voting. And Amazon has cleverly gotten USPS to install a mailbox feet away from the front door of the facility and is now texting workers to vote from there. Workers say they feel surveilled. So there are a ton of different tactics that they're using. They're passing out vote now t-shirts. They're passing around things that workers can put in their car to indicate that they're voting no. They're extending out care packages to workers who might be sick with literature about why they should vote no. The list goes on and on.
Is this legal? Does the National Labor Review Board allow this to happen during a unionization drive?
Yeah, so the NLRB, they allow, there's a very fine line about what you can and can't do. For example, you cannot ask a worker, are you voting yes or no? Do you support the union drive or not? But you can use other tactics like telling workers why, you know, maybe what negative things could happen if they join unions. You can basically lie and, you know, create propaganda about anti-union propaganda. You cannot interfere with workers' right under the National Labor Relations Act to organize. So you cannot retaliate against workers who are pro-union. You cannot surveil them or even create the impression of surveillance. So Amazon is occupying this gray area where they have these top union busting lawyers in the country figuring out ways where they can sort of bend the rules without breaking the law and get their anti-union message across.
Do we know if other Amazon warehouse locations are also looking to unionize, or are they looking to Alabama for inspiration?
Yeah, actually last week, a group of Teamsters local in Iowa announced that they were organizing two distribution centers in Iowa. We've seen a huge uptick in organizing in Amazon warehouses since the pandemic started and since Amazon, you know, briefly offered $2 of hazard pay and then took it away and briefly offered unlimited unpaid leave and then took it away. We've seen walkouts and organizing going on in Sacramento, in Queens, New York, in Chicago, near the Twin Cities in Minnesota, in the Inland Empire of California. These organizing drives are, some of them are with the help of a union, some of them are independent, worker-led. Those ones, the latter ones I just mentioned, aren't directly a response to what's going on in Alabama. They were going on beforehand, but I think a lot of people feel galvanized and energized by what's going on in Alabama. So I think we can expect to see more of this, regardless of whether the union wins in Alabama or not.
Lauren Corey-Gurley is a staff writer at Motherboard, Vice's tech site. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We reached out to Amazon for this story, and spokesperson Heather Knox sent us a statement. Here's an excerpt. We don't believe the retail, wholesale, and department store union represents the majority of our employees' views. Our employees choose to work at Amazon because we offer some of the best jobs available everywhere we hire. And we encourage anyone to compare our total compensation package, health benefits, and workplace environment to any other company with similar jobs. It's important that employees understand the facts of joining a union and the election process. We will provide education about that and the election process so they can make an informed decision. Companies are permitted to communicate with their views about unions or a specific union to their employees, just as unions may freely express theirs on the same topics. You can read the entirety of Amazon's statement on thetakeaway.org.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC. Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
Hey everybody, I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. In Hong Kong's latest conflict, 47 pro-democracy activists were charged Sunday with conspiracy to commit subversion under the national security law that China imposed on the city last year. The hearings started Monday and have continued for the past 3 days, during which the people arrested were deprived of sleep and food. 4 people were hospitalized as a result. If convicted, the defendants could face life in prison. How will this impact Hong Kong's opposition movement? Here to break it all down for us is Shibani Matani, bureau chief of the Washington Post covering Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. Shibani, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong have been fighting for the past 2 years. So what is the significance of the latest development?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really huge deal because essentially it takes away every single opposition leader in Hong Kong from public life. These are people who've spent their lives campaigning not just for democracy, but also for LGBT rights, women's rights, environmental issues, workers' rights, you name it. And they were all essentially arrested and have been fighting over the past 4 days to get bail, which is under Hong Kong's common law courts, should be a guarantee, but under the national security law, which, as you mentioned, was imposed by Beijing, the standard for bail is much higher. So we've just had a decision come out of the courts here in Hong Kong where the judge granted 15 of them bail, but ordered that the other 32 must remain in detention before any kind of trial. But immediately, the government's Justice Department appealed that decision. So we're back to square one.
If these activists remain in custody for a long time or are jailed for life, what does this mean for Hong Kong's opposition movement?
Yeah, and I think what was really remarkable here is that, you know, over the past few months, we've already seen a closing of space for any kind of opposition movement or any kind of democratic expression here in Hong Kong. You have changes being made to schools, to the legislature. A lot of these people who were arrested were disqualified anyway from running for elections ever again. All the tools are being used against them and against Hong Kong to essentially crush opposition and ensure that there will no longer be dissent. I think the point here is that, you know, the use of the national security law against this group doesn't just ensure that they won't run in elections again or they won't, you know, be part of these political parties again, but it's really showing how draconian these measures are, that, you know, it's not enough that they kind of disappear from public life, but that they be punished in the most cruel possible way, that they be taken away from their families, that they be taken away from their wives, their children, because Beijing just truly wants to punish them.
Shibani, how might this case impact the independence of the courts?
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting and salient question. I think at the heart of this issue is, you know, can Hong Kong's independent judiciary, can Hong Kong's common law system ever be compatible with a law that was drafted by Beijing, which does not have an open legal system and actually has one that's very politically influenced. And I think with this case, you're already seeing those two systems bump up against each other in a very serious and a very concerning way. And that's a problem not just for, you know, the people in Hong Kong, but for businesses, right, who have had their base of Asia operations here for decades, who use Hong Kong as a center for arbitration, for finance, and, you know, just for doing business. And you know, when they see something like that, you have to wonder who's next. One day it could be opposition activists, next day it could be someone else, right? I mean, you never know when you're going to sort of fall afoul of the authorities, especially when the law is written in such a broad way. So I think that's something that's very concerning to everyone.
Okay, a lot to think about Hong Kong there. And Shibani, you also cover Myanmar, and there's a lot to get there as well. Yesterday, more than 30 protesters, including a 14-year-old boy, were killed by security forces in Myanmar, making it the deadliest day since the militarized arrest of State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi in early February. Over 1,000 people have been arrested since the coup began, including journalists. Shibani, why are we seeing this kind of escalation now?
So a resistance movement has been building since the military seized power on February 1. And people in Myanmar detest what's happening in the country. They voted for Aung San Suu Kyi and her civilian government. They revere her, and they were sick of the military running their country for 50 years and really welcomed participation in the democratic process. And so this movement has been building, but the Myanmar military does not have a good track record of negotiation or really, you know, compromising in any way. And for the first few weeks there, it seemed like they would sort of hang back. They would kind of use arrests as the main tactic of intimidation or maybe even some tear gas, stun grenades. But recently, there's been a trend where they've started firing into crowds of people and really firing to kill, shooting to kill. They've been aiming for heads and chests of protesters. The photos and videos coming out are beyond gruesome. And really, they're using this as a crowd control tactic. They're doing it so that people in the crowd get scared and they run off and disappear at a very, very high cost. And it's truly shocking and gruesome. And the death toll's climbing higher than even the 2007 crackdown on monks, which was known as the Saffron Revolution at the time, which was when the country was still sort of fully in the grip of military rule before it opened up. So, yeah, it's very, very concerning.
And how have the killings impacted people's resolve to protest?
Yeah, I mean, it's truly remarkable. I mean, people have just gotten more and more resolute. I mean, today, in places where people died yesterday, they've come back on the streets in some cities where four or five people were gunned down yesterday. Today you see thousands more protesters coming out.
So, Shibani, what about the response from the international community? The UN Security Council is expected to hold a meeting on the situation in Myanmar on Friday. What are you looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I think the key question here is how Russia and China will act and how they'll respond. Russia and China in the past have been sort of notorious at helping to prop up the Myanmar military regime. The commander-in-chief, Minong Laing, last year went to Russia to kind of shop for arms and weapons and kind of, you know, ensure that there was a pipeline there. If these countries don't come out very strongly to condemn the coup, along with regional partners like ASEAN, Singapore being key to this equation, I think that the fear is that there won't be any real consequences. But, you know, at the same time, we must remember that the Myanmar military is used to being isolated. It's used to not having friends. It's used to being sanctioned. It's used to being an international pariah. And, you know, I think they're kind of prepared to go back to that if it means they continue their grip on power. I mean, I think at this point, if they were to negotiate, if they were to sort of compromise in any way, or, you know, kind of turn back the clock on this, their standing as an institution in Myanmar will be completely done. I mean, already you have soldiers and police defecting, people not wanting to listen to orders, and the military has always wanted to have this very central role in Myanmar, in Burmese politics. And so I'm just afraid that, you know, this will be another situation where they're going to continue to refuse to compromise in the way they have in the past.
Shivani Matani is Washington Post bureau chief covering Southeast Asia and Hong Kong. Shivani, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega. We're going to end today's show with something that's helped some of us cope in the past year: journaling. Now, there's no right or wrong way to journal. That's the beauty of it. But typically, it goes a little something like this. Thursday, March 4th, 2021. I've always kind of hated March in New York, and a year into the pandemic, that relationship hasn't gotten any sweeter. It's still too cold, too dark, and this time around, there's no escape. No quick trip to Mexico or a beer with my friends indoors. Okay, so this isn't an actual page from my own journal, but you get the idea. Journals, diaries, and other personal writings have long helped people document and reflect on their lives, but they've also been deeply valuable for historians and future generations. So how do we go about chronicling this global crisis in real time? That's something the Pandemic Journaling Project has been thinking about since last spring. A joint initiative between the University of Connecticut and Brown University, the project is working to ensure that the voices and experiences of people are heard and remembered during the COVID-19 crisis. Since May, they've received nearly 9,000 contributions from nearly 1,300 people in more than 40 countries. People submit written journal entries, but they also share their experiences in photographs and voice recordings.
What's affected me the most is the social distancing. I find myself aching for touch to give or receive.
There has been a lot of moments when you're alone with your thoughts. You can't really escape those, imprisoned.
To crush them in a hug or shake their hand or punch them in the shoulder, to hear their voice in person.
Just a lot of self-guilt, self-hatred.
Participants have also expressed what they're feeling through poetry, including this one about living through both the pandemic and the ongoing climate crisis.
La lluvia cae y anega todo. Anega los esfuerzos, el trabajo, todo lo construido. La lluvia cae y deja en la mirada de las personas una tristeza, un vacío, una pérdida.
These were the voices of just three of the 1,000-plus people who submitted journal entries in the past year. And for more on their collective experiences, we spoke with the two co-founders of the Pandemic Journaling Project. Dr. Catherine Mason is an assistant professor of anthropology at Brown University, and Dr. Sarah Willen is an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Connecticut and director of the research program on global health and human rights at the Human Rights Institute. And Sarah told me that they had a specific goal in mind when starting the project.
The first impulse was to make sure that we were recording the stories of people who were on the front lines, who were being directly hit as the pandemic unfolded. You know, at the same time, we together think a lot about mental health. Both of us do research on issues of mental health, and we thought it would be really beneficial for people to have a place to chronicle what they were going through themselves as a way to reflect and also as a way to, you know, to preserve their stories for themselves and for their families into the future. And so it was really those double motivations that got us rolling at the beginning, a sense that we needed to work hard to make sure history was full and rich and included the voices of all of those who were living through this moment, and also a sense that people would want a space to reflect.
Kate, tell us about the people participating in this project. How did you recruit people to journal? How intentional were you about creating a diverse group of participants?
We wanted to make this as open and broad as we possibly could. So from the start, we wanted to make this really, really easy for people to participate. Even if they don't have a computer, even if they can't speak English, even if they don't like to or feel comfortable writing. Mm. And so this entire thing can be done on a smartphone, and it can be done in English or Spanish. And we're very, very deliberate in trying to reach out as broadly and widely as we can, in particular to folks like essential workers who are on the front lines, and to communities of color who are being disproportionately impacted. We wanted to really make sure to get their voices as well.
Kate, in a time where we can all share, and most of us do share, our most private thoughts on social media, what is the difference between, say, recording a TikTok journal and writing one for this project?
You know, at the beginning of the project, there were some folks who said, you know, this whole thing's being recorded on social media, so why do you need another platform? And we think that this is just getting at something really different, because social media, as we all know, is a very performative and curated type of thing, right? We are all curating public selves when we post on social media. And this project is deliberately anonymous. It's confidential. There isn't actually the option to make your name public or to comment on anyone else's posts. We don't allow for commenting because we wanted this to be a space where people can really be honest with themselves. And we do see a different kind of tone in these entries than you would see on social media. It's much more raw. It's more introspective. It's more honest.
Sarah, what kinds of questions or prompts did you offer to participants, or was it more kind of free form?
We've worked together with a group of researchers and students also, and tried to think about how we could really pre-design a historical archive so that in the future we'd have people's perspectives on a wide range of aspects of everyday life. So some of the things that we ask are kind of intimate. You know, how is the pandemic affecting the people closest to you? How is it affecting your mental health? But some of the questions we're asking are much more about the world around us. For instance, do you know of any small businesses that have been affected by the pandemic? And talk a little bit about that. Or we ask about whether people have themselves or their community has encountered racism or hostility in any form. So the questions really try to tap into people's experiences of everything we've gone through. And when we think about this year, you know, it's been one form of disruption on top of another, on top of another. And all of those different aspects of the past year, from the social protests to the election to the forest fires to the inauguration, everything becomes entwined in the way people talk about their experiences.
Kate, what's the overall story you got from the thousands of entries? Is there a narrative through line?
It's really difficult to say at this stage, but we are seeing a lot of themes. One of the main themes really has to do with the longitudinal nature of people's participation. So we send folks who are participating a link to participate every week, and we've been doing this since last May. So we're now at about 10 months now that the project has been running. And we see that people's experiences are not static. Sarah mentioned the protests and, for example, the wildfires of last year, the election in the US. We see people reacting to all of those things in real time and shifting their ways of thinking and their emotions. There was a sense of optimism in the summer, a sense that this was almost over, a refocusing on political issues like the protests. And then as you get to fall, you see anyone who has children being very fixated on school and very worried about school from all different angles. And then as you move into the fall, you see things getting a little darker, you know, both in terms of the weather and in terms of people's moods. And then more recently, the hope with regards to the vaccine.
We've been talking about chronicling the lives and experiences of people during the COVID-19 pandemic with the two co-founders of the Pandemic Journaling Project, Dr. Catherine Mason and Dr. Sarah Willen. Before we get back to the work they've been doing, we wanted to give space to you out there who have turned to journaling at this moment.
March 10th, 2020, for several days now, I've been walking around with an intrusive and involuntary song popping into my head at the darndest times. COVID-19, yeah, you know what I mean. At this moment, it is everywhere. I've laughed at it a few times, but mostly not.
Hi, my name is Christian from Alta, and I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri, 4th October, 2020. After a few days of depression, I am astounded all over again by this simple landscape. The dancing grass, rustling leaves, everything alive and abundant, the trees, one fiery orange, the other Christmas red, singing autumnal songs amongst the green, end of season rhythm. The minuscule spider, whose shadow dances as it crawls, sprints across my page. How everything evolves to my adjusting eye as I bring it from the page. The green's a dusty gray that becomes painted vividly in by the yellowish tree in the distance, increasing with every brush stroke.
Saturday, February 13, 2021. Another transfusion day. Eating peanut butter and graham crackers from the hospital, drinking coffee from my new COVID coffee destination. It's a drive-through.
One morning you might wake up and sing hallelujah because the Wicked Witch is dead. One morning you might discover that hope is a feather as it floats into your hand, black and shiny. One day you might simply sit at the ocean's edge, dangle your toes in the water, and sigh with deep appreciation that you were here. My name is Janie Starr. I'm calling from Vashon, Washington. And I wrote that back in May 2020.
Like the listeners we just heard, participants of the Pandemic Journaling Project have been using their journals to work through the range of emotions they've been feeling since last spring. And Catherine told me there have been some common themes in those entries since the project started.
One of the biggest ones has to do with actually with gratitude, that we're seeing people being really struck with how grateful they are for what they do have. And we see this from people who are in sort of more objectively privileged positions, but also from those who are not, from those who have lost family members or have lost their job or even their home and feeling just grateful for what they still have. And alongside that, guilt that they are doing okay when others around them are not. We also see a lot of sort of broad existential angst. It's not just about the pandemic, but it's about the pandemic in light of the election and the social unrest and fears about climate change and all these other things happening in the world are all mixed together. And finally, we really see people working through and kind of calming themselves. There's a lot of resilience here that has been very interesting to watch as people kind of talk their own way through their own experiences.
And how do the journal entries you collected complement research and data about the mental health toll of the pandemic?
Many, many people are experiencing a tremendous burden right now where, you know, there's the uncertainty, there's the isolation so many people are feeling, a lot of anxiety. Many people who already had mental health struggles have found those to be exacerbated. The population level data certainly support that. What we're finding in the journals is that people do need a place to reflect, and a journal is a place that can serve that need for some people. You know, certainly participating in our project, we can't promise any mental health benefit, but we're hearing people reflect on the kinds of struggles they are experiencing. We're hearing people reflect on the ways in which taking this time, a few minutes a week, can be of benefit. And we're also seeing, as Kate was suggesting, ways in which people are finding ways to find little bright spots, to find joy, to find ways to have fun, to reconnect with people using the technology available to us. So we're finding some of those glimmers of hope.
And why is it important to chronicle the lives of ordinary people, especially during times of crisis? Kate?
This is a period of time that is going to be remembered by everyone alive today. This is a time that my 8-year-old daughter is going to tell her kids about. It's a time that is going to have a major impact on the whole world and certainly our own society. And so the story of that time and of what actually happened during that time and of what people were experiencing during that time, it needs to be told by as wide a range of people as possible. we thought it was really, really important that the story of this time not just be told through the newspapers and not just be told by those who are prepared to share that with the world and have the means to do so, but it's told by ordinary people just living their lives and, you know, trying to get up every day and keep going through this really, really strange plague year. And this is a space where we hope people can leave those memories, both for the history books and also for their families, because one of the things we wanted to make sure that we did was to allow people to download and keep everything they contribute. And so one of the things Sarah and I have talked about a lot is that, you know, when our children have their own children someday and are telling them about this time, to have a chronicle of everything that their own parents went through during that time can be a really powerful thing for a family in terms of their own family history.
Sarah, how long will this project continue? Does it end when the pandemic ends?
So we certainly will continue inviting people to contribute to their journals until the World Health Organization has declared the pandemic over. So that will be a kind of moment at which we say, is this a formal end? But we won't cut things off at that point. The pandemic will continue to reverberate in our lives for a long time. So we will continue reaching out to people periodically to see what's changed. Just to give a sense of what will happen to this material, as Kate suggested, anyone who contributes can download their own journal at any time. We will then, you know, once we do stop formal collection of material, we're going to put it all in an archive at a data repository at Syracuse University where researchers can work with it for the next 25 years under some limitations. And then after 25 years, the entire collection will become a publicly accessible historical resource so that people can continue to learn from our first person accounts long into the future.
Catherine Mason and Sarah Willen are the co-founders of the Pandemic Journaling Project. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much
for having us.
Before we go, we wanted to share one last musical journal entry we got from a listener.
Remember how life used to be when we were living virus-free? You don't, well, I don't either. Is it showing? For normalcy, I try to strive, but I've forgotten how to drive. And when I leave the house, I don't know where I'm going. Oy vey, virus, how you tire us. We're desirous that you go away. Oy vey.
That's all we have for you today, folks. I really appreciate you guys tuning in and sharing all of your journal entries with us. You can send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also shoot me a tweet at Rebe Ibarra C. And we can also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.
New level of